times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you're dumb pairing. Yo, baby, what's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. 'Cause baby,
you're listening to the Circle Day radio show on Resonance FM on 104.4 in London, UK, and also streaming online on resonancefm.com. I'm Chickpea, an independent radio producer and a member of the Dissident Island Radio Collective based in London. Tonight we'll be hearing from the Free Association and Friends. The next 30 minutes features a mix of an interview I did with Brian and Keir, two members of the Free Association writing group, interspersed with an audiobook recording I did of their recently published book, Moments of Excess. The audiobook was a collaborative project with the Free Association, Friends, and Family. The Free Association's writing and observations come from a perspective informed and inspired by involvement in anarchist and radical left, anti-capitalist political protest, organizing, and organizations, as well as a wealth of political and economic philosophy and theory. I find their writing to be articulate, accessible, and thoughtful in highlighting the complexities of understanding capitalism as a system and capital as a social relation, and their collective, non-individual, and anti-egocentric process of writing is also inspiring in challenging the conceptualization of the ownership and commodification of ideas. And without further ado, let's hear from the Free Association.
The texts collected here were written over a 10-year period, from summer 2001 to January 2011. All were initially written as interventions, one way or another, so it's no surprise that they betray their origin and context. One or two were originally written for books. Some appeared in movement publications, such as Derive a Prodi and Turbulence, and most were also handed out as self-published booklets in the heat of the moment. Yet, as we assembled this edition, we were struck by how well the articles hang together as a collection. They are coherent, and they tell a story. But before we think about what that story might be, there are a couple of points worth making. First, we write from a European perspective. More precisely, as we explain in What is the Movement, we write from a UK standpoint that is itself rooted in several different traditions. That doesn't mean we're not internationalists, far from it, but our writing starts where we are, which has been mostly within Northern Europe. Allied to this, we don't claim to represent any position within contemporary anti-capitalist politics. Indeed, any claim to represent a movement is a dangerous distortion. At best, a movement can only be sampled. In many respects, the trajectory revealed in this book is ours alone. But this disclaimer must be qualified by the second, more important point, which is that our writing has always been collective. At the outset, this approach seemed almost incidental, but over time it has become increasingly central to who we are and the way we work. Collective writing is a strange process, in equal parts painful and liberating. At the most immediate level, there's little room for ego or posturing because there's always someone on hand to cut you down to size. But the physical process of writing is itself far more complex. Our articles begin as group discussions which span several sessions and locations. The drafts that follow are circulated and discussed, often among a much wider network, and then re-edited so many times that no one can claim authorship of any one insight or line. The end product is richer, more complex, and far more nuanced than anything we could produce individually.
Out of May Day 98, to the four of us in Leeds, who'd been involved in Leeds Class War on Class War nationally and live in Leeds and had known each other for 6 or 7 years, went through May Day 98, were very instrumental in putting on that conference and helping people through it. And then out of that, we entered a series of reading groups, one sort of based in Bradford, but involved people in Leeds and Bradford, the one in 12 Club in Bradford. Mm-hmm. And then over time, we read a few to enable us. I think we had a discussion about money, and it was quite odd. It was quite an abstract thing to discuss, but we had nothing to prepare beforehand. So it's quite weird. You know, all you could do to prepare for is look in your wallet and see what money was, but that wasn't quite enough. So we read a few texts, but we found them quite, in a way, too easy to read in a group. By now, we were five. We decided to read Capital, not because we wanted to lock ourselves away and study, because Capital was some holy grail of Marxism, we must return to the original source. We were struggling, you know, speak for myself, I was struggling to understand my life. I was struggling to understand changes that were taking place where I was working. I was struggling to understand changes in class power and class struggle, and changes in how I could organise with other people who felt the same. One of the things I found really difficult was in class war, you'd be involved in organising meetings, you'd chair meetings, you'd facilitate meetings, although we didn't quite have that jazz hands terminology then. But we did a lot of work like that, and it was quite, I was quite used to doing that. And then at the time I was working in a large workplace with about 1,200 people. And where I was working, all of a sudden, those skills that I developed in class war suddenly became really valuable at work. And I found this quite disturbing, that I was having meetings at work with managers where I was using all the skills that I'd used in organising local political groups to organise work which would increase the profits of the company. And I found this quite confusing. So when we read Capital, we made a sort of pledge to ourselves that we wouldn't really be bothered about what Marx said or meant, because we'd never know what that meant, what that was. But we would read it and use it to try and understand what was going on in our lives. So we would meet every week and read a chapter, but we would then talk about anything that happened in the news and stuff that was going on, militarisation and, you know, police or, you know, cuts or whatever. And we would try and work those things out and read it through the sense of Capital. It's a kind of really useful tool for that.
As that went on, we started to think, well, we should start writing together as well as just discussing the world. It's almost like a natural process where you want, you know, you're trying to get at the world again. And one of the ways to do that is to sort of like read and sort of like talk collectively, and it's almost a natural process to then go through to start writing collectively. So that's what we started writing collectively, and so we needed a name for what we should publish this, and because it's a collective writing project. And so we first came up with Leeds May Day Group because of May Day 98. We used to go away every now and then when we had to write something. We went away, and quite often to our secret base in Staves. And during one long drunken night, we were trying to work out what to call ourselves. We didn't like Leeds May Day Group. It'd come about accidentally. And so Brian just kept going on about the Rebel Soul Force. He wanted to call it the Rebel Soul Force or something ridiculous like that.
And no, I think that might have been killed.
We were just going on and on about, come on, we've got to come up with something. So we just need to keep doing this free association of words, and then something will emerge. And we thought, oh, what about the free association? That works. Yeah, there's where the legend was born.
But it, obviously, the name, it kind of worked, because we saw it as an association of people coming together to freely to kind of work out what the f*** was going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's never been a membership group. It's not. We're neither closed nor open. So we have, right from the beginning, we would have written things, we would show them to people, and they would get feedback, we would talk to people about things, they would add things to it. And the way we write, because we were a collective writing project, it's quite labour intensive. We have meetings, we record them, we then transcribe the meetings, we circulate them, we add to them, somebody might produce a draft, then we have another discussion about them, someone else might go away and edit the draft, and then we might show it to a wider group of people who then add stuff. We also find things on the floor and steal them and put them in. And then by the end of it, you've got a text, and like, no one's quite sure who's written anything. But also, we all feel that we've all written it in a quite peculiar way. And there's quite a few times people said to me, oh, you came up with that line. And I'm thinking, no, I'm pretty sure I didn't. I think it might have been you. But it doesn't actually matter. And so there's a kind of openness about it. And I think there's also a depth in collective writing. It's very hard. But also, when we began, we were quite stilted. I think we got a lot better at it in the last few years because it's practice. There's an element of trust and of sort of commitment to each other. Mm-hmm.
So what is the story of Moments of Excess? Rereading these texts, at least three different narratives emerge from the threads that run through them. One is a tale about the movement of movements, focused on the cycle of counter-summit mobilizations that is usually reckoned to have begun with the WTO Seattle meeting in November 1999, but which can actually be traced back to the Global Street Party, which greeted the 1998 G8 summit in Birmingham and the J18 Carnival Against Capital the following year. At the time of writing, there is a clear sense that this cycle has come to an end. First stalled, and then definitively thrown aside by the economic crisis that ripped across the planet in 2008. One of the key questions raised in this period is the way intensive collective experiences, moments of excess, relate to everyday life. As these mobilizations expanded, we also began to think about the relationship between the problematics thrown up by social movements and the demands that they appear to express. But while it's possible to track the changing shape of the movement of movements in this collection, the reality is much more messy. For one thing, cycles of struggle don't begin and end as neatly as we might like. So the lineages we propose, from anarcho-punk to Seattle, for example, are entirely subjective, related to our own political and personal histories. Again, while some detect a brand new politics in the anti-austerity struggles now emerging across Europe, others rightly point to the battles which raged in Africa against IMF-imposed structural adjustment programs in the 1980s. So there is a second, wider thread here about the form of politics appropriate to the world we live in. Neoliberalism's ideology of permanent progress through growth may have been shattered by the economic crisis, but it staggers on, zombie-like, and unprecedented cuts in public expenditure across the world are actually expanding its program of social decomposition. As cracks appear in the most unlikely of places, there's space to ask the one question worth asking. What sort of world do we want to live in?
It's 3 a.m. We're midge-bitten and piss-wet through, hiding out in some woods 2 miles from the A9 in Scotland. We spent the last few hours like extras from The Great Escape, stumbling through the countryside, dodging police cars and helicopters with searchlights. Now, we're trying to get a couple of hours' kip in the open air, worrying about how we're going to manage that last yomp to the road and how we're going to block it when we get there. In the back of our minds is that conversation we had discussing the possibility that the police will send dogs into the woods to flush us out. We're tired, hungry, and nervous. One of us starts to giggle. It's infectious. Before long, we're all shaking hysterically, cracking up at the sheer insanity of the situation. What the fuck are we doing? How did we get here? This is madness. It's what alcoholics call a moment of clarity. After being caught up in the logic of the situation, you get a flash of objectivity and a sense of its ridiculousness. Hang on a minute. Perhaps we ought to reverse that. Capitalism is organised in an entirely rational way. The only irrational thing about it is the whole thing, capital itself, which exists only to increase its own value. The bottom line for the whole system is the expansion of zeros on an accounting sheet. From that point of madness, a delirium sweeps through the whole of society, making our lives seem out of control. Just as a sailor who returns from months at sea can feel dry land swaying, it's capital's delirium that you perceive in a moment of clarity. It's not us that's insane. In fact, we, our movement, are the realists. Of all the organisations, groups and actors circulating around the G8 summit, we were the only honest ones. We were the only ones not offering pie-in-the-sky solutions. It's obvious wouldn't be tried and wouldn't work anyway. The only ones not asking our leaders to do things. We know that they can't and won't do anyway. Anything we want to happen, we do ourselves, here and now. You end up in some mad situations when you try and act sane in an insane world. but it's a different kind of delirium we're after.
It seems like there's always these goal-oriented things of trying to bring down entities that and symbols of capital representation. But then, what is capital?
I think that's exactly it. I think capital is an incredibly hard thing to get at, because it isn't actually anything other than the social relation between humans. It's a particular way.
And we exist in that social relation. So, like, if you have a fish that lives in deep sea, asking it to describe water would be pretty difficult for it.
Doesn't know what wet is.
Yeah. So basically, you know, what we're saying is, you know, you do have these moments of excess where perhaps the fish jumps out of the water. So we do have something to compare it with, but basically we are within this web, and it's a social relation. Social relations are abstract. You can't point to them. What tends to happen is we try to get a figure that stands in for this really complex social relation, such as the rich, which is what we used to go on about a lot in class war, or perhaps the bankers, which is what people talk about a lot now.
Finance capitalists. Big business or corporations globalisation or any sort of figure. It is what people call a real abstraction. To hold these things in your head is really difficult, and you would need to personify them in some way or objectify them and see them in something. I actually think that's a necessary moment. I think you need to do those things. You need to identify some sort of enemy in order for you to gain traction, because otherwise you're just grappling with nothing. It's like fighting with mist. The problem is that people get stuck with those personifications, so that capitalism becomes the rule of big business. And you think, well, if capitalism is the rule of big business, if we eliminate all big business...
Right, just have small business.
Have small business. Is that okay? And then, okay, let's eliminate all businesses. Okay, so we eliminate all businesses, but is it okay still to have money? Yeah, you know, do we just work for nothing? But hang on, do we still have work? And it's like, well, actually, the more you think about it, the more capital as a social relation, you know, dominates our lives. It doesn't totally absorb every element, but it does dominate our lives. It shapes everything. But because it shaped everything, it's so hard to get a grip on. And that's what we found. I mean, that's partly why we spend so long reading books, talking.
Part of the reason you want to read Capital. So you think, the book Capital by Marx, because he sort of starts off, he takes it at a very abstract level, and he says, you know, well, basically it's a load of money which is invested into production. So you get people to work in a factory to make more money. The increase in money can only come from one thing. It can only come from humans. They're the only ones who can add value to anything, basically. It's not the machines that add value. And so that's the dynamic, that's the basic dynamic of capitalism, right? Is the need to invest that money in order to get more money, but that can't stop there. You then have to invest that to get more money, basically. So it's a constant need to expand and for capital to keep growing all the time. And any individual capitalist who doesn't meet or beat the market norm for the amount of profit goes out of business. Well, in theory, would be on the streets destitute, in fact. It's not a conscious decision. It doesn't have to be a conscious decision by capitalists to try to exploit you or to try to get the most money or try not to be nice and sort of, I'm going to run a nice business. If you try to run a nice business and the market norm is more than a higher profit that you can get from being nice, well, they have to follow that market norm or they go out of business, basically. So it's this constantly expanding dynamic. And that's a dynamic that we're caught in as workers. But it's also a dynamic that people who are capitalists are caught in.
Yeah.
And Marx has this image that we've conjured up this dynamic, you know, as though from the netherworld. You know, sort of like a horror movie thing. We sort of dug up this sort of like dynamic, and it's started to take control and sort of like start to expand, and we're all caught up in this thing. And so it's easy, like the Sorcerer's Apprentice type thing, that the Sorcerer's Apprentice have summoned up this force that they can no longer control. Richard Branson is as much in the grip of this dynamic. He can't stop, he can't get off. Do you know what I mean? And his horizons of what's possible are completely constrained by this like inhuman dynamic of capital. We can explain it like that, but then you have to move from that to, like, you know, well, yeah, I'm walking down the street, you know, where does capital exist? Is it over there? Does it live over there?
Yeah.
And that's when you start bringing in things like, oh, it's the rich, isn't it? It's the rich that...
Because it's easier to target the rich, to say that capitalism is the fault of the rich, or it's controlled by the rich. But actually, it is a social relation that we're all caught up in against our will. If I don't go to work, I will lose my job, and then I will lose my house, and then I have a family, and we won't be able to feed, and it's, like, pretty grim. So kind of you caught up in this thing, and, you know...
Yeah, you also get up for work, Brian, because you got up for work yesterday and it's just become an ingrained habitual... And so that's, you know, even though we have these moments where that breaks and things seem much, much more possible, you know, a lot of your behaviour is not actually thought out. It's habitual. And capitalist social relations get ingrained in us And to the point where we're not actually sure where we begin and and the only time you can see that really is in these moments of excess points where things start to come together and you can see.
No, I don't think they're the only moments, but it's one of the moments.
I'm trying to sell the book.
Nice.
That was Capital Social Relations talking in me.
You cannot escape.
I'm back in control again now, yes.
The phrase moments of excess helps us make connections between exceptional moments in everyday life. Work in a capitalist society automatically creates an element of excess because it is ultimately based on cooperation that can never be reducible to capital. Our abstract potential always exceeds and tries to escape the conditions of its production, that is, the capital relation. That's why we think there's life despite capitalism. Because as a living, breathing mass, our needs, our desires, our lives constantly transcend the limits of capital. What do we mean when we say limits? Capital needs to make a profit, and to do this it needs to impose measure upon our activities, cramping our creativity. For example, most of us in work have some job description, however vague, laid down by management. Yet if we restrict our workplace activities to those duties, nothing meaningful would ever get done, which is why work to rule can be so successful. Similarly, capital needs to codify everyday practice into laws which relate to sovereign rights-bearing individuals, even though this contradicts the way that innovation actually occurs. In fact, capitalist culture tends to reduce all collective products of creativity to the sole property of individuals. Brunel built this. Faraday discovered that. On top of all this, we have to factor in our everyday, partly unconscious refusal to be homogenized, flattened, measured, or made quantifiable. In the most obvious sense, then, there is an excess of life. In work, at home, on the bus, we produce a surplus of collectivity. This is our humanity, and it is this which capital is constantly trying to appropriate, harness, regulate, or contain. All this has become more obvious over the last half century as capitalist social relations, seems to have leaked into every aspect of our lives. At the same time, and of course related to capital's colonisation, work, our daily activities, has become ever more socialised. It's no longer just a matter of the extraction of surplus value in the workplace. Capitalist production is now inserting itself deep into the texture of our day-to-day social existence in such a way that it now makes sense to think that society itself functions as a factory. But this increasing socialisation of labour has opened up new possibilities for cooperative and creative collectivities within capitalism that seem to lead beyond it. As work spreads throughout life, so does the cooperation it relies on, and it is this excessive cooperation which makes transformation possible.
Summits and plateaus. When the powerful meet, we meet. When the leaders of the world's richest nations, largest corporations, most important institutions gather to make decisions on how power will be administered, we, the motley, the rabble, the troublemakers, the ne'er-do-wells, the multitude, gather to exercise power. Summits are our summits. What happens at them? On the face of it, they're about protesting, about being against things. But in fact, what we do is far more positive. We spend time together, we demonstrate together, maybe we riot a little, we talk together, we argue together, we dance together, we drink together. Some lucky ones even fall in love. In short, we live. And we change. We don't come out of it the same as we went in. All of this organised in non-hierarchical, non-authoritarian ways. Frequently messy, rarely perfect or pure, but usually in such a way as to give us all realistic hopes of doing it better next time. And what of before? Organising mobilisations against, say, the Group of Eight G8 summit is an immense amount of work, involving perhaps several hundred people doing stuff up 2 years in advance, with obviously many, many more people as the date approaches, and far, far fewer for most of the months before that. An enormous amount of work. Media stuff, networking stuff, legal stuff, health, accommodation, liaising with NGOs, trade unions, political factions, local government, and all of this coordinated and done with no leaders, no one telling others what to do. And again, frequently messy. Journalists, leftists, politicians frequently ask, OK, so you're against G8 or the World Bank or the... But what are you for? What an absurd question. We are for this. This openness, this way of organising, this way of living, of being, of producing life. When we look at it like this, it's not about how to fuck them up. It's not about how much damage we can cause. It's not about them. It's about us. Of course it's easy to see why we keep getting dragged back onto this territory. Our summits take place in opposition to theirs, so we always end up talking about the G8, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, etc. But the reality is that Blair, Bush and Berlusconi meet and talk all the time. They have computers and telephones. They don't have to meet at G8 summits. So whether or not we prevent them from meeting doesn't really affect their power to make decisions. But our effect on their ability to meet is an index of the other worlds we are living. It is almost a measure of their possibility. Our summits and our movements aren't about destroying capitalism by fucking things up. They're about expanding our own possibilities, turning ever outwards, excavating capital's power to make its world pointless. Over the last few years, the period following summits has seemed, almost by definition, one of decline. Our sense can be one of deflation, of coming back to earth, of returning to the world we have fleetingly left. Our normal world seems hollow, our jobs seem pointless. This is hardly surprising because we feel we are irrevocably changed by those collective moments of intensity and creation. The problem is how this energy, these moments of excess, can be sustained. This is nothing to do with maintaining summit links, preparing for the next one, keeping in touch, or anything like that. Every meeting or gathering seems to end with someone, or all of us, suggesting yet another mailing list to continue the discussion, to make our wealth-producing machine permanent, and then passing around a piece of paper to collect email addresses. We're certainly not suggesting that we shouldn't stay in touch, but human beings maintain long-lived connections in different ways, more one-to-one or small group-based, and founded on shared labour, personal attractions, simply clicking with one another. When we slip back into thinking about formal lists or networks, we're making unnecessary assumptions about what the movement is or should be. We revert to organisational, bureaucratic ways of thinking about ourselves as a way of trying to keep something wonderful going, when those ways of thinking are the antithesis of what that something was. The movement isn't a defined collection of people. It's not a network of groups. It's not even a thing. It's a process, a becoming. Summits are singular movements, moments of excess, during which we change individually and collectively. At Gleneagles, we'll produce immense collective wealth and experience new ways of being. It's this we need to keep in mind as we discuss the event and how we organise for it. New processes and possibilities will emerge, and it's crucial that we don't try to close these down and jam them back into preconceived notions or schemes. It's vital that we allow our creativity and our energy to flow freely. It's in these circumstances that our collective intelligence can ignite to generate other worlds, that we can connect the present moment to those moments of excess yet to come. Our experiments in new ways of being are limited only by our imagination. Let's keep it open. See you at Gleneagles.
'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone.
And so it's time to wrap up this episode of the Circle Day Radio Show on Resonance FM. And thanks for listening to this half hour featuring words from Brian and Keir of the Free Association, as well as excerpts from the Moments of Excess audiobook. You can listen to the entire audiobook by finding a link on the Circled A Radio website or by searching for Free Association audiobook on your search engine of choice. All the recordings are copyleft for nonprofit purposes and free to download and share. You can also find out more about the Free Association and get links to their current and past publications, including their book, by going to the Free Association's website at freelyassociating.org. And before signing off, many thanks and solidarity to the Free Association, friends, and family for their time, energy, and thoughts that allowed these recordings possible.
For the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all.